Call the next case, Kenny v. Denbo.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Robert Kenny, appellant and plaintiff pro se in this matter. I would like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal.
We'll give you 5 on rebuttal. That's the maximum.
Okay. I'm assuming you're all familiar with the facts.
We're familiar with the facts. We're here to talk about count 2. What would really help us is if you walked us through understanding what these discovery rules were like, both in the internal grievance, the college's procedures in the arbitration, and where would we find what discovery requests you or your representatives made for these emails? How do we know that these were specifically asked for and not turned over? Because that seems central to whether there was fraud.
Right, I have it right here. There was a letter to the provost, which was quite broad in what it requested.
Do you know where in the record that is?
Yes, I do. I have it here someplace. One moment, please. There was a email that asked for...
Do you have a date? Do you have a record citation?
I have it in here. The user's discovery request for documents disclosed in the investigation was very broad. It asked for email records, blackboard records, correspondence, etc. That's ECF number 173-6.
Is that in any of your appendices, or do you have a date on it?
No, I'm afraid it's in the district court record only, 173-6.
I think that's citing the union rep's deposition. Help her.
It is. I'm sure it's in the appendix, too, someplace.
Do you have the wording of the discovery request?
Well, yeah, I was quoting it. Email records, blackboard records, correspondence, etc. We'd like to have notes, documents, and that's a direct quote. Email records, blackboard records, correspondence, etc.
Relating to?
The investigation of the... alleged breach.
Right, so if it's not related to the investigation, then it wasn't responsive to the request.
Correct. And...
Was there any request that was specific about the email traffic among Denbo, Sprotzer, University related to your use of the syllabus or the provision of the syllabus, but not related to the investigation of those things, but the underlying facts?
Well, I see what you're saying. If the request from the union did not contemplate that the university would be denied some emails in their investigation.
Okay, let's back up a minute. You didn't make requests of your own. These discovery requests are coming just from the union rep. Is that
correct? That was my exclusive representative. They have exclusive jurisdiction. I couldn't ask for it myself.
Okay. And for there to be a fraud claim, there has to be some misrepresentation.
Right.
That you asked for something, they didn't turn it over, and you were misled by the failure to turn it over. Was there anything in the rules that required them to sua sponte turn over all the documents related to this? Or did the arbitrator request any of these things?
No, to the last question, the arbitrator didn't request anything. He made his decision without any testimony. what the fraud is they both, the department chair Spratzer and defendant Dembo asserted in writing that plaintiff had used her syllabus without her permission. They failed to mention that they had given directly to the plaintiff a written copy.
Your argument is it's misleading because it was a partial truth that obscured facts that undercut or contradicted. Where are the assertions that you're alleging were misleading? Where are the written assertions that Spratzer and Dembo that made to you that you received in the course of the grievance or the arbitration?
In plaintiff's appendix 411 and 493-94 are the written assertions that plaintiff had used her syllabus without her permission. Contradicting that were written emails that she withheld, or somebody withheld, contradicting that. Their sworn testimony, 3 years, it took 3 years and four deposition requests to get them under oath.
You say plaintiff's appendix, I'm looking at your appendix on appeal, volume 2, and those page numbers don't appear to be responsive. What are you citing?
Volume 2. I thought I was citing the plaintiff's appendix. Wait a minute. It's their initial emails accusing him of using the syllabus without her permission. That is contradicted by her own emails that she didn't submit, or somebody didn't submit.
Point me to these emails.
I'm sorry. There's sworn testimony several years later contradicted the emails.
Okay, but point me to the emails.
One second. I have the reference. One is to the discipline letter. It says, I find that your use of Susan Dembo's syllabus without her prior permission is a violation. 3 years later, they testified under oath. And from that, the union assumed, well, Department Chair Spratzer must have taken it from his files without consulting her.
Where was your request for these, or the union? Can you point me to anything where the union requested things beyond the investigation to the underlying provision of the syllabus? Are you aware of anything?
It's not that they denied something on discovery. The defendants withheld communications that would have contradicted their story during and
if they withheld it, what was their obligation to turn it over? Where was the source of their obligation?
Well, the obligation was when the university was investigating, she gave the university apparently certain emails, but not others. So the failure to disclose was in the investigation. There are emails that contradict your story. It's not discovery abuse that constitutes the fraud. It's the assertion in the initial accusatory emails that said you did not have my permission. 3 years later, when they were placed under oath, they contradicted that story. In the footnote, she says that she, number one, Department Chair Spratzer testified under oath that he solicited the syllabus. He didn't just take it out of his file without consulting with her. He solicited the syllabus from Dembo. Dembo gave it to him with complete knowledge and understanding that it was going to be given to the adjunct teaching her course.
So how would this have affected the outcome of the grievance procedure, the arbitration, or the settlement, if you had known this? What can we see in the record that suggests that this would have influenced any of those?
It's not complicated. She alleged that the syllabus was used without her permission. That was untrue. When we came to testifying to that under oath, she backed off. She admitted that it was solicited by Department Chair Spratzer. He didn't just take it out of his file and give it to her without consulting her. She was consulted, and she consented to the use of her syllabus. The initial accusatory emails that said you used the syllabus without her permission were false. It's not complicated. When it came to testifying under oath, they pulled off short because that's perjury. They misrepresented and...
Might have been incorrect. That doesn't make it a lie. It's a different person asserting this from the person who, Professor Denbo, who actually knew this.
No, Professor Denbo said, told people in her initial accusatory emails that Kenny has used my syllabus without my permission. Department Chair Spratzer covered for her by saying also you used it without a permission. And the important point on this is for the remedy of rescission, you don't have to prove they lied deliberately. If they lied even, if they failed to tell the truth even negligently, and the...
Okay, but rescission isn't, rescission's a remedy. Count two, which we've granted argument on, is a fraud and equitable fraud.
Right, and the remedy for that is rescission.
Right, but normally there's, I see what you're saying, because there's a scienter requirement for fraud.
Right, equitable fraud is where you merely fail to state the truth, and the, now what the defendants have said, well, there's no proof, there is reliance. In the record, there is proof that the union, for its part, assumed that Department Chair Spratzer took the syllabus from his files without consulting Defendant Denbo. That's not true. And they testified, when it came to testifying under oath, the story changed.
But was the extent of the use in dispute?
No. No, it was just he had no permission.
I mean, I have taught courses, and I got a syllabus from another, this was trial practice, from another professor, and I looked at it to plan out what I was going to do, but I didn't post it anywhere as my work.
The issue of attribution is what I call that, was not what he was disciplined for. After the testimony, not backing up their allegations, their written allegations, the defendants tried to make the discipline about something else that they didn't testify inconsistently on. All of a sudden, the offense became no attribution. Okay? Every witness in this case said, testified they've never seen or heard of attribution of a syllabus, including Defendant Denbo, under oath. Okay? Grievance Officer Halpern said, if it was about attribution, it would have helped immensely, because nobody's ever heard of that. This may be the first case in this country where a professor has sued over plagiarism, alleged plagiarism of a syllabus.
Right, Mr. Kenny, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll hear you there. Thank you, sir. Mr. Gerber?
May it please the Court, Stevie Gerber, attorneys for Rider University, and Professor Susan Denbo. Let me start with the large conflation in the case, which was just identified in Judge Roth's question. Continually and throughout this case, plaintiff's argument has conflated erroneously his receipt of Dr. Denbo's syllabus with her name on it and the content therein, admittedly so he could look at it for the purpose of framing his own syllabus, with what he did, which was copying it wholesale and posting it on his own name. As the district court says, Mr. Kenney knows how he received the syllabus.
I took Mr. Kenney's theory to be different from the one the district court understood it to be. The district court thought this was all about his state of mind. I took Mr. Kenney's theory liberally construed to be a jury would look at the factual issue of permission differently if it knew that Professor Denbrough had in fact turned this over and he hadn't just taken it from some general file of all the syllabi online. So I thought the district court didn't quite get what he was getting at in terms of she really did give permission to cast the whole thing in a new light. And the district court had a lot of sympathy for Mr. Kenney. The district court said, your client, Professor Denbrough, has greatly overreacted here to what's pretty common borrowing in the academic world. Now, the scale of the borrowing should have been changed more or less, but the district court had some real sympathy, and if the district court had understood his theory correctly, especially in light of this withholding, mightn't the result that the decision to settle have been different?
No, Your Honor, respectfully, it would not. The district court expressed sympathy for Mr. Kenney, but the district court also made it clear that one, and this is undisputed, that under the collective bargaining agreement, mm-hmm. the syllabus was Dr. Denbrough's intellectual property. That is undisputed. That was bargained for. The collective bargaining agreement governed the grievance, and indeed, that is the sole remedy for the discipline that was at issue. The issue is not, as the record below makes clear, whether or not Dr. Denbrough intended for him to read it, to have it, or Dr. Sprotzer have it. He knew he received it. It had Dr. Denbrough's names on it, and he copied it intact.
Can you enlighten us on the discovery issues here? What are the discovery rules here?
Your Honor, when you come and you think you have everything you need, you don't have absolutely everything you need. There was, I believe, in the record below, but I don't believe it's in Mr. Kenney's appendix, nor do I believe off the top of my head it's in mine. The discovery provisions are governed by the arbitration and the arbitrator. The request by the union, and this is referenced in Dr. Halpern's testimony, and indeed it's even referenced in his letter, which is annexed to the Castanguero certification, and I can give the DA reference to that. DA 60 and 61 is the union's letter. The union requested the documents that the provost relied upon in the provost's letter imposing the discipline. That letter is DA 66, and it makes reference to the syllabus that Mr. Kenney received, which was Dr. Denbrough's syllabus, and that's in the record, that's appendix attachment A, and it makes reference to Mr. Kenney's, quote, his record of unauthorized use of the syllabus about a week and a half before the course began when, quote, Professor Kenney posted Professor Denbrough's syllabus virtually unchanged as his own and without acknowledgement on January 14, 2012, about a week before. The only thing the union asked for were the documents that the provost, Dr. Stephen, relied upon. There was no separate and independent procedure for discovery. The CBA provides that there's an arbitrator who shall determine it. Of course, under United Mine Workers and its progeny, those arbitrations are intended to be final, as they are. And for that reason, by the way, there can be no rescission. The right to bring the grievance and the sole authority to bring the grievance over the discipline is that of the union. Mr. Kenney consented to the settlement, but he was not the party which could bring the grievance.
If there were fraud, if there were deliberate fraud, we would balk at enforcing that. We might have stopped somebody or saved that person out of unclean hands.
Right, but there was no deliberate fraud, and there was no equitable fraud. And the courts, The court's point below, where it says that no jury could reasonably find that Mr. Kenney reasonably relied, which is, as you know, an objective standard, upon whether or not three emails did or did not come over, when there was no procedure for wholesale discovery. These proceedings are very, if you look at the CBA, which is in the full record, and I forget the DA site, the collective bargaining agreement, it provides for step one, step two, step three, 14 days, 30 days to an arbitration. There's no discovery proceeding in there.
All right, so that's the position of the law. Let me ask, why haven't your clients settled this matter? Just as a matter of equity, the district court pointed out your client, Professor Denbo, overreacted greatly. The union representative Halpern testified, never heard of anybody going ballistic over the use of a syllabus. So why take this issue all the way up?
Well, Your Honor, because we were sued. Let me just back up on that. The issue of whether or not Professor Denbo's language, while not libelous, was intemperate, is really not the subject of this point that the court's clear.
I'm not concerned about the language. I'm concerned about the behavior of a powerful full professor who has a lot of sway with the university coming after an adjunct professor over what, in the grand scheme of things, the district court finds and our experience is not that big a deal.
Well, Your Honor, it might not be that big a deal were the core underlying fact different. The core underlying fact that makes it a bigger deal here is that the collective bargaining agreement and the union, perhaps unusually, bargained expressly that syllabus were the intellectual property of a professor. And to the extent I don't concede that she, quote, overreacted, she created a brand new graduate level course that was then incorporated in the Master's in Business Administration. She intended to write an article about it, an academic article about it. She developed all these course materials. The syllable that he produced also included designations of sections and readings and the like. And it was intellectual property of hers, pursuant to the university's agreement with the union. So it's not perhaps as in some other institutions, and Mr. Kenney was a professor there and a member of the collective bargaining unit at that time for, I think, about 15 years. It's well known that that is wider faculty members' intellectual property. And that's the reason why the university exacted the discipline it did. As the provost wrote, and I think that this is rather telling, issues about whether or not it was inadvertently or intentionally available, issues of whether or not it was given with knowledge that the adjunct was going to use it, that's not the issue. The issue is the use of another's intellectual property without permission to use it as your own. It's the use as his own, as the provost said. That was the telling factor, and that's in the Castagnaro assert. That's really never been disputed, but that was the core of the case. And that's what sets it apart, respectfully, Your Honor. It's not just, I read the syllabus, I like this idea of a concept about an SEC issue for business ethics in terms of Section 9B for a course in business ethics for MBA students. That's not the issue. The issue is the title of it, the class, the homework assignments, and the like. All that is intellectual property. It's as if, Your Honor, the argument would be, I write an article, and somebody else takes out sections of my article and publishes it as their own. That's what has occurred here. The syllabus was Dr. Denbo's. He knew it was hers. It had her name on it. And he literally copied it, changing 8 minor alterations that are undisputed. So I don't think it was an overreaction in the context of it's her intellectual property. The faculty all know that intellectual property is there. And the fact that Mr. Kenney chose to copy the property because he didn't have time, because he was away over 8 weeks, to create his own syllabus doesn't say that.
To the legal issue that Mr. Kenny raised with us, which is there is something misleading about putting forward an assertion that he used this without permission and saying Spotzer gave Kenny the syllabus and omitting the fact that Denbo gave Spotzer the syllabus. I'm not sure whether a jury mightn't find that Denbo's handing the syllabus over might have authorized more generous or more complete or more verbatim use of the syllabus than maybe even Denbo thought she was authorizing, but it could reasonably have been understood that way. Doesn't that look like a perhaps material omission? In turning over a whole bunch of other emails and then leaving these out?
No, Your Honor, and the three emails in question don't really bear on that, and I can point out for you where they are because it's not clear. The three emails are referenced in the paragraphs 86 through 88 of the Fourth Amendment complaint. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so one of them is an email from the Office of Technology person back to Professor Denbo in the first place, talking about this blackboard system and whether or not she had intentionally, quote, elected to allow stuff to be seen by others in the university or not. And by the way, so on that email, the fact that you publish an article doesn't mean that somebody can copy an article. The fact that the syllabus was on the blackboard or not on the blackboard is not material. The second so-called undisclosed email is an email talking about later learning or learning at that time that there was a new general default with the blackboard update. Same issue, same not material relevance. The issue is not whether it was published in Time magazine, whether it was published online, or in the University of Pennsylvania Law Review. The issue is taking somebody else's work and copying it. And the third email was that Denbo had given him the syllabus. Well, Kenny believed it was available according to his own submissions, the union's submissions, because he saw it on the blackboard. Availability does not equate to passing it off as his own. Use does not mean one cannot read it. Yes, he had the opportunity to read it. People in the university had the opportunity to read it, just as they would a published article. Using it as your own was the evil. And that is an evil in academia.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gerber. We'll hear Mr. Kenny on rebuttal. Mr. Kenny, could I ask you to begin with this question? Is there any evidence in the record that Provost Stephen reviewed any of the three emails in question?
And there's some circumstantial evidence. The packet that was handed over to the union had some strikeouts where as if three pages had been removed. In other words, there was a number there that was originally 75, and it was changed to 72.
The packet that was given to the union when at the hearing? Or?
Before the hearing, in response to their discovery request.
So the inference you're drawing from that is that somebody reviewed the package and took the three emails out of the package.
Possibly.
Because it's three pages.
Yeah, there's
we don't know whether that was Provost Stephen or someone else, right?
In his office or somebody else. I want to get very quickly out. The charge was not exact copying. The charge was not no attribution. Grievance Officer Halpern has testified if it was attribution, that would have been easy. It would have been even easier if it was exact copying. Plaintiff has submitted exact copies of Denbo's materials that he had copied in the past with Denbo's knowledge and approval. Moreover,
respectfully, I don't think we want to re-litigate the merits of that, right? I mean, the issue here is could you plead a fraud action, right?
Okay.
And the issue on that, I think, comes down to, you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, as I understand it, you're saying, I really would have liked to have seen these three emails before I decided to take the rep's advice and settle this case. Is that
fair? That's not the fraud. The fraud is...
What is the fraud?
The fraud is both Department Chair Spratzer and Defendant Dembo asserted that I used their syllabus, her syllabus, and that I broke into her Blackboard site. And
well, that's false testimony in the course of the administrative hearing process, right?
Yes. And
that's different than a common law fraud action, right?
The thing that proves it's fraud is they reversed themselves when they were placed under oath. In other words, in the accusation is you used this syllabus and you broke into a Blackboard course board to get the syllabus, and 3 years later, when I finally get them under oath, they reverse themselves. No, I gave it to Department Chair Spratzer, both of us fully knowing that it was good. She gave it.
Dembo admitted that she gave you the syllabus.
And with her permission.
Right. But you're saying that wasn't her first position. That was her first.
No, the whole allegation, there would be no discipline.
But then why isn't that a good thing? I mean, why isn't it, to the extent she later admitted that, no, actually, I did give it to him.
With the full
permission, that's a good thing, right? It would have been a lot worse if she had, under your theory, lied and said, oh, no, I didn't give it to him. He just stole
she
it.
She did lie in those emails that were the sole basis of my discipline.
But isn't it your position that the discipline morphed over time? That was part of... They sort of... I understand, you know, your complaint to be that, you know, I was under attack here, and I'm fighting an ever-changing battle, because they say one thing at one point in the process, and then they change, and it keeps changing.
When she was placed under oath,
right.
They both can't be true.
But you can't... Do I then understand that your fraud action is that...
That she is...
You want to undo and then redo or avoid having to go through the administrative process because it...
It was based on fraud.
It was based on...
Her misrepresentation.
It was based on misrepresentations.
Yeah, it's very, very clear. This is not complicated. She very clearly said, I used her syllabus without her permission, and then when she was placed under oath, she contradicted it. So, they can't be true.
Right, but once the people... at the school deciding whether discipline is appropriate, they presumably took into account what she said late at the hearing, which was, I'm terribly sorry.
That was in this lawsuit.
Three years later,
after pressing discovery with four deposition requests, we find out that Department Chair Spratzer admits that he solicited from her, and they both admitted that she gave it with her permission. In other words, she misstated in the arbitration. Two more things I want to get in is...
Well, there's an email between you and Professor Dembo in January 23rd, and you have admitted there that you asked her permission. So she was aware of everything, and you were aware of everything.
No, what I asked her permission about was using other resources. Her initial allegation and why she went so ballistic was, I posted syllabus listing her course resources and student assignments. She jumped to the conclusion, well, he's using my assignments, right? Sworn testimony, and that the allegation about resources was dropped even before the discipline was imposed. Because it was very clear her resources had not been placed on my Blackboard site. All she had to do was look at it, and she would have seen that. So that was dropped. The resources allegation was dropped immediately because it was unmistakably untrue. What the email you're referencing is when I called her and asked her if I could use anything else other than the syllabus. You've already given me the syllabus, and I know I can use that. And I had exact copied her work in the past, and when I was appointed priority adjunct, I was praised for that because I was borrowing from the faculty and using them as leadership. Please look at the collective bargaining agreement, which says, suggests that that syllabus may be intellectual property in certain circumstances. Department chair's grievance officer Halpern stated under oath it has to have creative content to be intellectual property. I really want to get this in because this collective bargaining agreement says syllabus can be intellectual property.
Where do you want to point us to? Where in the record should we look?
That is the CBA, it's Defendant's Appendix 470-471. It says, as a matter of principle, the university encourages the members of the bargaining unit and all members of the university community to publish without restriction their papers, books, and other forms of communication in order to share openly and fully their findings and knowledge with colleagues and the public. The academic ethics is we want the broadest distribution. Consider, if you will, what happens to the university if every adjunct has to start from scratch. The persons that have been mentioned in this case are the ones that are hurt, the students. It is harder to maintain continuity if every adjunct has to start from scratch. Also, so what she said...
Mr. Kenny, we've let okay. you go way past your time, but do you want to make a couple of quick concluding points?
Yes, two things.
Okay.
This court deals with a lot more serious matters. You deal with pain, you deal with death. I'm in pain. Who is going to hire a 70-year-old adjunct with a stain on his record? Also, what she's asking for here is directly because it's necessary that we pass on syllabi. That's why they had that in the collective bargaining agreement. We want the widest available distribution of our academic work. And they weren't even thinking about a syllabus. They were thinking about copyrighted articles, copyrighted research, that sort of thing. Least of all, a syllabus.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kenny.
Thank you.
The court appreciates the argument of both sides, and we assure you we take this matter with the utmost seriousness as we do all our cases. The court will take the matter under advisement.